Anyway, can I just say welcome again, everybody? Very nice to see you all again. I face you kind of bleary-eyed because I stayed up to 2:30 to watch the US election. And in this job, you never get any free time. I had to get up for an 8 o'clock meeting, so I haven't had much sleep last night. But when I went to bed, Gore seemed to be well on the way to winning. Then when I got up, Bush seemed to have won. But now it's all open again. If you're I hope you're following this on the internet. You can follow it very easily. There's another recount. Gore conceded and then phoned Bush again to remove that concession. So there still isn't a clear outcome to the American election. Someone I was just talking to asked me to mention what it all means in relation to these things I'm talking about in these lectures, which I will try and say a bit about at the very end of this lecture, which is a lecture about politics. It's a lecture about government, and I mean, my view is that government and politics still do matter for reasons that I'll try to elaborate during the course of these lectures. Now, if you look back over the post-war period, the period leading up to the time that I was discussing in the first lecture, and the whole post-war period, you can say apart from revolutionary communism, which is now thoroughly dead, dark, dead political philosophy, two basic political ideologies have been dominant. You're talking here primarily about Western industrial countries for much of this lecture. I'll be talking about other parts of the world in subsequent lectures or what these things mean for other parts of the world. But in the post-war period, in the industrial countries, in the first, 25 years or so, after the Second World War, the dominant political philosophy was essentially reformist socialism, parliamentary socialism, which emphasized the role of the state, which placed a lot of stress, too, on the role of welfare institutions, which regarded the state as the prime agency of social development, economic change, and attacking inequality. That was a period of sort of consensus around the position of the welfare state because right of center parties accepted this too. This was a period dominated, if you like, by traditional social democratic parties on the one hand, left of center parties, and Christian democratic or right of center parties on the other hand, but the dominant agenda set by the left of center ones. This was seen, for example, in this country in the idea of one nation Toryism. Most Tories, before Mrs. Thatcher came on the scene, were one nation Tories. One nation Tories or one nation conservatives believed that government had an important role, believed that the welfare state should be central to contemporary societies. So both left and right shared a good deal in common over that issue. That was supplanted from about the mid-1970s onwards by the dominance or increasing dominant position ideologically of free market political ideologies. Free market ideology is sometimes, you'll see it quite often, referred to as neoliberalism. Or in its more vernaculars as Thatcherism or Reaganism, they all mean more or less the same thing, except the latter two refer to particular countries, where the first one is a broader notion. Neoliberal doctrines sought to attack the pre-existing consensus about the role of the welfare state and about the importance of government generally. Thatcherism, neoliberalism, sought to argue that the main source of social development, economic change, and social justice should be found in the market, that markets have a prime role to play in contemporary societies, and that government should be downsized as far as possible. If the first type of thinking, traditional left of center, social democracy, saw the market as the problem and the state as the solution, the second type of political philosophy was the reverse. It saw the state as the problem and the market as the solution. So a pretty fundamental reversal in political ideologies. Mrs. Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were in power for quite a long time in the US and or in the UK and the US. There weren't such periods of strong neoliberal rule in other European countries, but nevertheless the ideology of neoliberalism, the ideology of the preeminence of the market became the dominant ideology, and left of centre parties found themselves responding to that. Well, if the first political age is over, if traditional social democracy is now largely disappeared, and if, as I would say, the second is now over, that is, people have come to see that you simply can't run the world as a gigantic marketplace. The electorate in most countries, including the electorate in the American election yesterday and this morning, have by and large rejected the idea that markets can stand in the place of other social and political institutions. Electorates in Western Europe have put in place some 12 out of 15 EU governments, which are left of centre governments. The logic underlying this, I think, the electorate are saying, although we don't want to go back to a world dominated by a large bureaucratic state, electorates don't want that, actually. That's what all opinion polls show. Electorates also don't want to be left unprotected in the face of the big changes I described in the last lecture. Electorates still want care and protection from government, investment from government. They don't want to be dominated simply by markets, but they don't want to be dominated by the state either. So you've got a third shift happening in politics, a shift which is happening not just in the industrial countries, but, as I mentioned at some point, across the world, where people everywhere are looking for a third alternative to these two dominant pre-existing post-war political philosophies. And that's why this term, the third way, has caught on quite a bit, the third way. The title of this lecture series in some part, because people are looking for a third alternative. This is just as true, I think, of developing parts of the world as it is for the more industrial ones. Now, before launching in the substance of what I have to say, I have to mention that the term third way is an entirely dispensable label, and I have to make it clear what, in my understanding, that term refers to. It's not a particularly good label for two reasons. One is that, as you can easily spot, I'm sure, it lends itself to easy humour. I mean, it said if you go into a restaurant, you should never make a joke about the menu because the waiter has heard it about 100 times before that day. Well, any joke about the third way, I can assure you, I've heard 100 times before in the various talks I've given around the world. So you get the usual things, fourth way, 15th way, Milky Way, Frank Sinatra's My Way. There are endless permutations around the term. So the term is perhaps not the best in that sense. Second, more serious qualification that you have to enter is that it's not at all a new term. I sometimes get interviewed by journalists who say, well, you invented the term third way, didn't you? But I mean, that just shows you how little journalists know, because you can trace the term third way back about a century. The first use I found of it was in the 1890s, when it was used in France by movements that used to be called solidarist movements. They were a particular style of a French political movement. The term third way has then, in the current century, been used by many different people of many different political persuasions. Sometimes it's been used by parties of the right, including the far right. Usually, though, term third way has been used within the history of social democracy. That is, left of center parties, left of center thinkers have made most use of it. For example, if you look at the evolution of social democracy in Sweden, the Swedes have often used the term third way to refer to a kind of period of change happening within the evolution of social democratic doctrines. But the term is in no sense new. It's been used many times before. Therefore, that's why one must stress that it is an entirely dispensable label. For me, the term third way is simply a label for a debate which is going on across the world about how you create a decent and egalitarian society in the face of the social changes that I tried to analyze in the first lecture last time. So you can easily substitute other words for the term third way. For example, modernized social democracy. Any version of social democracy coming to terms with the changes I mentioned last time. That's what this debate is all about. I carry on using the term third way, at least for the time being, because it's achieved an amazing global currency. It's somehow caught on many different parts of the world, and at the moment there are some 40 self-declared third way heads of state or heads of government in different parts of the world, ranging from Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe, Western Europe. So the term has caught on in this amazing fashion, but I would ask you to remember that nothing at all hangs on the term. Nothing at all hangs on the term. The term third way now does not mean what it meant in the late 1960s, for instance, when it meant a form of market socialism. It does not mean that. It means what I mentioned earlier, the attempt to find a decent political philosophy which will allow us to cope with the big changes transforming the world, because the two dominant pre-existing philosophies have failed to do this. We do have to look for something which might have continuities with the past, but is not simply a continuation of past policies or past political outlooks. Now, I should stress that for me, the third way or third way politics is definitively a left of center political philosophy. It is a left of center political philosophy that simply stands in existing social democratic traditions, but recognizes that classical social democracy or classic left of center political philosophy has been inadequate to deal with the changes which we confront. Therefore, we must make innovations in it in order to politically effectively confront the changes that are happening all around us. Therefore, to me, the term third way is an attempt to argue that the classic values of the left are not only just as relevant to a globalizing world as they were before, but are perhaps even more relevant, and that the underlying theme of them, government and the state, politics, rather than becoming less relevant, I think, as the neoliberals argued, have actually become more relevant to a globalizing world than was the case in the past. Not less relevant, but more relevant. What are the classic values of the left? Well, I think they're fairly easily described, at least in outline. To be on the left, as I would understand it, is to want a society which is solidary. It is to work which is integrated, cohesive. It is to want a society which is inclusive, where no one is left out. It is to want a society that is egalitarian, that recognizes that you cannot allow inequalities simply to expand indefinitely. It is to want a society which offers care and protection for the most vulnerable members of the population, no matter where they are found. And crucially, it is a belief system which argues that you need government to do this, that these things will not flow automatically either from existing institutions or from market structures. If these are the classic values of the left, third way politics is an attempt to show how these values are still central, how they can deliver electoral success to politicians certainly, but how they can also inform an effective political agenda. Modernization here does not mean what modernization meant in the 1960s, which is a kind of uncritical worship of technology, when Harold Wilson in this country talked about the white heat of technology, modernization in that sense. This is a primitive view of the notion. Modernization now can be precisely defined. It means, again, responding to the changes I described in the previous lecture. Modernization is bringing our social, political, economic institutions up to date in such a way as to allow us to cope with the implications of the changes which I described under the three categories last time. So in sum, third way politics is about the modernisation of social democracy, it is about the persistence of left of centre values, and for me it stands or falls as a left of centre project, and that is its driving force. As such, all of this is in some respects new, as I hope you'll accept. The changes going on in the world are profound, no one fully understands them, so it's not surprising that the third way debate is an evolving debate. It's not a fixed political agenda, it is a dialogue which is going on across the world between left of centre political thinkers and left of centre parties to attempt to construct a genuine and an effective political agenda. However, I think that a core set of agreed principles and policies has emerged from that debate. I think that agenda now informs the policies of every left of centre party in power in the European Union at the moment, and also informs a good deal of the policies of left of centre governments in other parts of the world too. There are six basic features to this agenda which I mention in this lecture, although I want to elaborate on these and elaborate on some of the issues raised by them in the subsequent three lectures which follow on from this. So I'll list six basic points of what third way politics or renewed social democracy is all about, the concentration of areas which it covers. First, in third way politics, you no longer simply accept the view of the traditional left that the state is the solution to our problems, and you make a differentiation between active government and the state. There are two reasons why this needs to be done. First, we have come to see that existing state structures are inadequate in many respects to the tasks they're called upon to perform. So simply putting more tasks in the hands of the state is very often not a solution. Second, all states and all forms of government must respond to the emerging legitimation deficit in contemporary societies, which is that people vote less than before, that citizens are less interested in orthodox politics than before, that particularly the younger generation displays the lowest level of interest in orthodox parliamentary mechanisms. If you look at the generations, you look at political surveys of them, the older you are, in almost every Western country, the more likely you are to vote in major elections. There's a direct correlation. Goes down through the age groups until you get to age 18 to 25, when there is the lowest level of turnout in the large majority of industrial countries, showing that you're dealing with something structural here, not a problem of a particular country, but a generic issue, the deficit which has emerged around the structures of democratic politics. Now, before just expanding briefly on these issues, I'd like to say something very strongly, which is that third way politics for me is about a retrieval of active government. It's not an attempt to concede to the market, it's almost the opposite. It's an attempt to reconstruct, to recreate public institutions, to make the argument that a decent society must have decent public institutions. Those institutions must also be decently funded, incidentally. It's an argument that in a democratic society you must have public space for open dialogue. Therefore, you must, for example, contest media monopolies, because it's a crucial part of effective public institutions that the force of the better argument is the driving force of democratic politics, not power, not money, not other means of influencing decisions which people might use. The whole of third way politics is a defense of the role of the public, but argues, unlike the traditional left, that the public and government are not the same as the state, and especially not the same as existing state institutions. So we have to confront these two problems: the bureaucratic state, the ineffective state, if you like, and the democratic deficit, emerging democratic deficit in industrial countries. The first, most left of centre parties now have tried actively to tackle the first by trying to decentralise government often, by trying to get more transparency in government institutions, by cutting back on overstaffed bureaucracies within governments. The object, I think, is generally accepted by most left of centre parties now. You need to make government, as far as possible, as active, as quick on its feet, as responsive to citizens as businesses tend to be in the marketplace. You can't have a society where business on the whole is effective, quick-moving, dynamic, and the state or government are simply slow, unresponsive to the changes around them. So the logic of the transformation of government and the state is to make those institutions quick on their feet, accountable, and transparent. Of course, in practice, it's very difficult because you're asking institutions almost to reform themselves. But in most countries, considerable progress has actually been made, I think. Look all across the world, from Brazil to Korea to West European countries, you see that whatever the difficulties, progress has been made on this agenda. The second part of it is perhaps even more difficult, how to respond to declining levels of interest in and alienation from politics. Well, we do know something about how to respond, I think, and current left-of-centre politics, I think, is responding. We know, for example, one of the reasons why the younger generation is disillusioned with politics is that politicians are seen as corrupt, as self-serving, as more concerned with their own interests than with the interests of the majority, as male-dominated rather than egalitarian sector. Most politicians have been men in the past. Those are public institutions dominated by men. Well, programs of constitutional reform can help to address some of these issues. I think the devolution of power is important, and it brings politics close to the people. I think anti-corruption measures are important, as you can see from what happened to Mr. Kohl in Germany, that even the apparently most central sectors of European politics are not free from corruption. Moreover, however, in addition to these things, we need to understand that politics must include more than it's done in the past. Many younger people think orthodox politics, does not address the most important issues in our lives. An example is ecological issues. Many younger people are very interested in ecological issues. Most orthodox political parties have not got a substantial grip on them. This includes, I think, New Labour in this country, which is simply taken by surprise by what's happened in the fuel crisis, not to mention what's happened in the floods and its presumptive links to the wider global warming debate. All these things are like a package of reforms of government and the state, difficult to achieve, but the agenda is fairly clear. And I think there is a reasonable chance to re-legitimate politics. Other measures should be used as well. I mean, I don't know if you've been following the American election. It's quite interesting. A much higher proportion of postal votes have been used this time. You can vote before the election in quite a number of states. Increasingly, you'll be able to vote electronically. A lot of information about the election was provided on the internet. The internet is plainly going to play a bigger role in the legitimation of politics in the future than it has in the past. So you have a cluster of things which at least give us a chance, I think, of reconstructing government institutions, reinventing, if you like, reconstructing an adequate role for government. Second, in third way political agenda, a crucial area is the role of civil society, or the so-called third sector. Civil society, or the third sector, refer to the non-profit areas of social life, the voluntary sector, other areas outside of the economy and outside of government itself. One of the great discoveries, really, of the past 15 years, which began in the East European communist countries, was the crucial role of civil society. Third sector groups play and must play a significant role outside of the state and government, to balance out, if you like, state and government. We know a lot more, I think, now than we did 15, 20 years ago about what a good society is like. A good society is one where you have active government, but where the state does not dominate. It also must be one where you have an active civil society to balance out the powers of the state. But it also must be one where you have a competitive market, but where the market does not dominate social life. If you allow the market to dominate social life too much, you get too much instability, too much inequality in the wider, and too much commercialization of everyday life. So a good society is one which has a balance between government, civil society, and the market. That's the best, I think, that anyone at the moment has come up with for such a model. However, civil society can't be just traditional civil society. It has itself to be dynamic if it's going to be effective. For example, there have been some very interesting studies done of industrial regeneration in the United States in the face of the knowledge economy and the technological transformations it's bringing. These studies show that the US regionally has been very good at responding to the changes posed by globalization and the new economy, especially good on a regional level, but it's only worked where these three agencies are all involved in a balanced form. In a successful industrial regeneration, you've normally got government involved. Government give money to a local area where old industries are being transformed by new ones, but where government doesn't dominate. Where you have an involvement of business, but where you don't simply have the imposition of corporate power. But crucially, where you have active third sector or civil society groups. The research shows that where you don't have the active involvement of the third sector, local community groups, bottom-up groups, if you like, industrial regeneration in the United States has not been successful. So you need a kind of analog to this overall balance in order to achieve effective economic regeneration in these circumstances. An awful lot of material about modern politics is now about civil society and what the relationship should be between government, market, and the third sector or the civic sector. But I think one can say that no society which does not have an adequate civic culture can have either an adequate democracy or a satisfactorily functioning market. This is rather the central notion of democratic institutions, I think. I think we have to insist that democracy is not the same as consumer rights. The basic mistake which neoliberals or Thatcherites made was to assume that the two are the same. Democracy is not the same. Citizenship rights are not the same as the right to roam the aisles of a supermarket. Citizenship rights have to be protected and given within the wider framework of a democratic system. Citizenship means good democratic culture linked to good government. It's not the same as market participation. It can't be reduced to market participation. I think we see many of our areas of our life where this is a big threat, where the market has replaced rights and obligations which should be truly rights and obligations of citizenship. And we know that having a good civic culture is central to all of this. You only have to see what's happened in Russia and the painful struggles and transition in Russia to see how significant an adequately developed civic culture, civic consciousness, civil society organizations are to a decently functioning society in contemporary times. Third, the role of the economy. The new left or third way politics has quite a different view of the economy from either the traditional left or the market-inspired neoliberal right. There are two things worth mentioning under this category. The first is that what we now see is that in the knowledge economy, especially in a globalizing knowledge economy, every society must invest heavily in education, especially in education for the young, but going on to lifelong education, because this is a world of much bigger technological change than ever happened before. Governments need to invest in infrastructure, in communications technology, in information technology, because it is the economic medium of a great deal of the new economy. Only societies which are able effectively to mobilize resources in this way, and this includes poorer countries as well as richer countries, will be able to compete in the globalizing knowledge economy in an effective fashion. I should stress that these things are in no sense special to industrial or developed economies. The globalizing knowledge economy will affect everybody, is affecting everybody already. There is no way round giving education, social, intellectual capability a central role, and supporting the communication structures and educational structures which underlie it. So whereas the old left tended to look for traditional social intervention of a Keynesian type, and the new right or the neoliberal right wanted to leave everything up to markets, the new left or third way politics argues for large-scale government-backed intervention in the new infrastructural resources which are crucial to succeeding in a knowledge-based global economy, and argues that this is true of all economies, no matter how poor, how rich, although obviously there are issues in how you set about this in a poorer country as compared to a richer one. Second aspect of a shift in economic orientation in politics, third way politics insists that you must connect social and economic policy. That is to say, you must not separate fiscal policy or taxation policy from social policy, things that affect people's lives or inequalities in a society. On the other hand, you mustn't separate social policy from fiscal policy. All social policies have economic implications, and all economic policies have social implications. One way of seeing why this is so important is to put it the following way. The two traditional theories, you could say, are what you might call half theories. Traditional left of center social democracy was very good on social justice, but not very good on economic competitiveness, job generation, and things that follow from economic competitiveness. The neoliberal right was quite good on economic competitiveness, but simply gave up on the issue of social justice. So you need an economic theory which reconciles social justice and the economic imperatives necessary to compete in the new global knowledge-based economy. This in turn presumes fiscal innovation. Left of center parties and left of center intellectuals have now come, I think, to accept that under some circumstances it's better to lower taxes rather than to raise them, especially when lower taxing or lower taxation, whether it's on business, individuals, income tax or whatever, where it generates greater levels of employment, you can end up with a bigger tax take and therefore more to spend for government than if you'd kept taxes high. This is really big movement away, I think, from the past. Let me again put it in a fairly concrete way so you can understand what I mean. One of the things that we're aiming for in the new left of center politics is not so much to counter unemployment, but to generate employment. And we've now come to see, people in this dialogue, I think, that crucial for a society is having a substantial proportion of the available labor force in employment. This is normally called an employment ratio. That refers to the number of people in the labor force who are actually in jobs. Core driving element of third way politics is that you must have high employment ratios, at least in developed countries, because then you're not spending masses of money on unemployment benefits, and you can spend money, public money, on what people really want, which is primarily everywhere, good education, good healthcare policy, good transportation, and pension rights. Those are the four key things, really, which in all Western countries, the majority of the electorate wants. You can see how important this is if you look at a comparison between employment ratios of different countries. If you take Denmark, for example, or the UK, the employment ratio of these two countries is somewhere up near 78%. 78% of people are in jobs. And these are jobs which are supported by a minimum wage, so You can say the majority of the population in these countries are in decent jobs insofar as they're within the formal labour force. You compare this with Germany, France, Italy in Europe. Germany and France have employment ratios of only about 62%, which means that in those countries, a lot is being spent on unemployment benefits for people who could otherwise be in decent jobs and hence can't be spent on the things that they need to be spent on. In Italy, believe it or not, the formal employment ratio is only 50%. So they, you see a society with major structural weakness in its capability to support welfare institutions. So if you produce fiscal measures that help in job creation, you get the majority of people in good jobs protected by a decent minimum wage, with government intervention to support labour markets, you can create a society where you at the same time have well-funded public institutions. And this has been achieved, I feel, by the Labour Party in this country. That is to say, the reason why Gordon Brown is sitting on a large amount of money that can be spent on public goods is not to do with fuel directly, it's to do with the fact that they chose the right policies to achieve this mix. High level of employment, therefore not wasting so much money on unemployment benefits for people who could be in jobs, therefore being able to spend on the key public goods which people want. Whether they can spend in such a way as to deliver what people want, well, that's another matter altogether. That is much more difficult than practical political issue. Fourthly, reconstruction of welfare institutions. Reconstruction of the welfare state is crucial to the new left of centre politics. Again, this is true in societies which have welfare systems. It's also true in societies that don't. Societies that are trying to build welfare systems, like Portugal in Europe, or Greece in Europe, or Latin American countries, have to learn from the debate about the welfare state, because one of the fundamental things we've discovered is that the welfare state was a thoroughly contradictory phenomenon in terms of its consequences for the social values it sought to promote. In other words, to put it more bluntly, the welfare state has caused problems as well as helping to resolve problems. Again, to break it out in two, there are two reasons why welfare systems in all Western countries need to be reformed and are being reformed, greater or lesser success. First, welfare systems were established at a time before the changes I mentioned in the last lecture came to be prominent. Therefore, existing welfare provisions are often completely out of line with the risks and the inequalities that people face today. Take one example of that. I mentioned big changes on the level of everyday life. That's meant that in lots of Western countries, you have many single-parent households. Single-parent households in many countries, not all countries, but in many countries, are the largest category of the new poor. There are new sources of inequality which the old welfare state tends actually to make worse rather than to improve. Therefore, you must reform welfare systems to recognize those changes. But second, you must reform welfare systems because of the problems the welfare state has created. Some are easy to point out. For example, some of the biggest problems with crime and social exclusion in Europe are on the massive housing estates which were constructed with public money in the 1960s. They were supposed to produce better housing, better community for the people involved in them. In most countries, they proved disastrous. People in dilapidated housing estates in France or in the Netherlands or in the UK, often among the poorest, most deprived sectors of contemporary societies. Good example of a well-meaning welfare measure which has more or less completely rebounded from the intentions of its founders. But there are many others too. We know now that, for example, some forms of unemployment benefit, which were set up by architects of the welfare state with the best motives, had the effect of locking people out of labour markets rather than helping them get into jobs. There are many examples of that from the European countries, especially continental European countries. You don't want suboptimal or contradictory consequences of that kind. finally, we know that welfare dependency is real. It's not just something which has been imagined by the Thatcherite right. There are many cases now documented. The fact that dependency on welfare institutions can become a culture, that culture can be a dependency culture, it again can lock people out of the mainstream in the wider society in a way which is more or less completely opposite of what the founders of welfare institutions intended. So those issues and others must be dealt with by the reconstruction of the welfare state. Fifthly, third way politics looks for a much more sophisticated approach to ecological issues than was available before the last 10 to 15 years or so. Until that period, there was always a red-green conflict in most countries. A conflict between the traditional left and the new ecological left, if you like. The reason for that was that most people on the traditional left look for economic growth, development of employment as a key part of their outlook, whereas most of those on the green movement argued either for zero growth or saw economic growth as intrinsically harmful to the ecological fabric of the earth. Well, we know things are not like that. Now we know from many innovations in different countries, and this is a theme which has come to be known in the literature as ecological modernization. We know that technologies, forms of economic practice which are beneficial for the environment often create jobs rather than destroy them, are often positive for economic growth rather than antithetical to economic growth, so that in many circumstances, particularly with technological innovation, you can produce a much more virtuous circle between economic growth, which most societies need, and especially less developed countries must have. You must have economic development because that's the only way we know of overcoming poverty, something which I'll be discussing in the next lecture or the one after that. You must have economic development, but you don't want economic development which is ecologically destructive. Now, it isn't the case that in all circumstances you can produce such a virtuous connection, but we do know that that is expanding, and we do know that information technology can play a role in it. As the more economies move to information economies, the less they depend upon the types of pollution which drove the old industrial economy. So there's a great deal of action around those issues. However, there's a second part to this as well, of ecological discussion. A lot of ecological discussion is not really about the environment. I think this has only recently again come to be fully appreciated. It is primarily about one of the things I described in the first lecture, that the ever speeding up impact of science and technology on our lives. A great deal of the ecological debate is about risk management, especially risk management in relation to technological change and scientific innovation. It's obvious enough in the case of GM crops, obvious enough in the case of BSE, but it's also true of the global warming debate or most aspects of ecological debates. They're really debates about risk management. You must therefore have a politics of risk management. Successive governments in this country have made a mistake about this. The Tories made the mistake of declaring that beef was safe. No one could know that contaminated beef was safe. The Labour Party more or less made the same mistake when they declared that GM foods were safe. No one can know that whether GM foods are safe or not, because it's too early in their life, as it is in other kinds of genetic technologies. So we must always have a balance of the beneficial versus the dangerous aspects of scientific and technological development, which means you can't leave it up to the experts, which means you can't let scientists decide for you, which means you must have open public debate involving lay people, politicians and scientists, because no one has a final answer to what the risks actually are in most of these technological areas. It must be a matter which is brought within the general penumbra of democracy. Sixthly, third way politics seeks to take globalization seriously. You might think that's a strange thing to say, but I don't think most people and most forms of politics have done until recently. People will accept that there is a debate about globalization. The term globalization, as I mentioned, is everywhere. You know, it's a term which one might use. You recognize that it's there. But then politicians or political thinkers simply respond with national policies or local policies or whatever. Now, of course, responding to globalization needs national and local policy, but you must respond to globalization globally. Globalization is not a figment of someone's imagination. It is a massive set of changes transforming the world. It offers us many opportunities as well as problems. And those opportunities must be grasped through increasingly effective global governance. You cannot have a society, if you take the point I mentioned earlier, a good society is one which balances civil society, the market, and government. If that applies on a national level or a local level, it must also apply on a global level. At the moment, we do not have that balance in the global system. We have a world which is in many respects dominated by corporate power, by an expansion of market relationships. You need competitive markets, but you don't want them to repeat to dominate your life, whether within a national, local, or a global scale. Therefore, third way politics advocates a new internationalism. It argues that post-1989, with the advent of the globalization agenda, the world does not look the way it did in the past. New communication systems, including the internet, give us a lot more opportunities for global governance than previous generations had. Global governance must cover increasing stability in global money markets, avoidance of crises of the sort which ripped through East Asia about 3 years ago, must include control of the means of violence, the management especially of local wars, must include attempting to invent democratic mechanisms above the level of the nation. When I said earlier that government is more important in the world than it used to be, not less, I didn't just mean the nation state. I think here you're talking about collaboration between numerous forms of local government, national government certainly, but transnational government as well. Look at what's happening in the European Union. You can see all these things going on simultaneously. For example, cities now often exist in networks with one another, not simply within a nation, but across much of Europe and sometimes across much of the rest of the world too. The European Union and its future, I would suggest to you, is a theme I'll come back to subsequent lectures, is more of a model for transnational governance than the United Nations, IMF, or World Bank, no matter how important they might be. The reason is that in the European Union, with all its problems, and it has got a problematic future, the European Union is not an international organization like the United Nations is, a traditional international organization. The European Union is the first example in modern times where states have given up or pooled large elements of their sovereignty in order to face collective problems together. The EU developed as a Cold War project. Now you have to see the EU as a bridgehead towards governance in the global age, in the global arena. To me, it doesn't matter whether the European Union is European, really. What you're talking about is the pioneering of forms of governance above the level of the nation. And it's crucial to ask in what sense can these structures be democratic. If you look in Latin America, you see parallel developments happening with Mercosur, still a free trade area, same with NAFTA in North America, the same with ASEAN and other organizations in Asia. All of these, I think, should be treated as emerging forms of regional governments which could be linked to a more expanding structures of global governance. The global agenda is a really big one because of the issue of inequality. Not just global inequality, but national inequalities. I'll be spending quite a lot of time discussing the issue of inequality, probably in the next lecture, a week from now. It is an issue which we must all confront. But the need for global governance, the need for greater regulation of corporate power, the need to prevent future nation-state wars, these are a crucial part of the third way agenda. How would they relate to the American election in sum? Well, we don't know who's won it yet. But let's suppose that George Bush has won it. There are clear implications for all of the points that I made in George Bush's program. And it is possible that a Republican government backed by a Republican Congress could opt for isolationism rather than internationalism. I don't think that would be a good thing for anybody. It could push on strongly with the Star Wars project, which also I don't think would be good for anybody, including America. It could push on with more stringent anti-abortion laws within the United States. It could put more conservatives on the Supreme Court. In other respects, in conclusion, I mean, government does make a difference. You might think there's no difference between political parties. This is not so, I think. So I think myself, still a lot does rest actually on what the outcome of this election actually is, and I'll be scurrying back to my room now to find out what the latest developments are. So hope to see all or most of you next week, and thanks very much for attending this time.